from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear our guest host, Kim McQueen, interview the author Ian Frisch live in the studio about his new book, Magic is Dead, My Journey into the World's Most Secretive Society of Magicians, published last week by Day Street Books. Ian Frisch has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post Magazine, Bloomberg Businessweek, Playboy, Wired, and Vice. He has appeared on Bloomberg Television and speaks regularly at universities both about writing and entrepreneurship, and was a finalist for the 2016 Associated Press Sports Editors Explanatory Award. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. Magic is Dead is Ian Frisch's head-first dive into a hidden world full of extraordinary characters and highly guarded secrets. It's a story of imagination, deception, and art that spotlights today's most brilliant young magicians, a mysterious club known as the 52, who are revolutionizing an ancient art form under the mantra, Magic is Dead. In the vein of Neil Strauss's The Game and Joshua Foer's Moonwalking with Einstein, this book tells the fascinating story of one man's colorful, mysterious, and personal journey into the world of magic and his unlikely invitation into an underground secret society of revolutionary magicians. Here's what Publishers Weekly had to say. Frisch's enthusiastic deep dive into the world of magic is infectious enough that it might just send readers to the stores for their own magic sets. I'm going to turn it over to Kim and Ian. I hope you enjoy their conversation.
Ian, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I get to see you maybe once a year, once every couple years, when you visit Champlain College to speak with our writing students. And that's always such a blast, because we were just talking before we went on the air about how even though you graduated from Champlain in 2009.
Yep, 10 years now.
Wow. And
no, wow, I feel old.
And have been returning.
Which is like yesterday.
Have been returning every year to speak with Champlain students. But I was just remarking and just sort of realizing that you really switch it up every year. You keep it fresh. You sometimes are talking to the same students that you saw the year before, but you are always so great about sort of cueing them into your writing process, how you find work, how you develop stories. And that is always so fun for me. So it's really fun to get to talk to you, Dan, that you've written your first book. It's called Magic is Dead. It's amazing. I absolutely loved it, so much more than I thought I would. And we're going to get into why in just a minute, but I thought I'd ask you to start us off by reading from the prologue, sort of get our readers, our listening readers, our reading listeners into Magic is Dead.
Sure thing. So as a short primer, this is just a scene that comes from the middle of the book, but acts as a nice little segue into the beginning of the story. And the prologue is called This Is Me Now. Time was running out. Everything was falling apart. An army of slot machines dinged and whirled like a lazy, out-of-sync marching band. Corset-clad waitresses, faces layered in makeup, waited at the bar to pick up a fresh round of drinks. Off in the distance, tourists hitched up their belts, tossed fistful of chips onto horseshoe-shaped blackjack tables, and puffed on cheap brown cigars. I was almost jealous of them. The thrill of the big bet, the whiz and click of the roulette wheel, the pfft of the next card dealt. But I wasn't here to gamble. I slumped low in my chair, nearly defeated, stewing in the stale air of the casino bar, crumpled cigarette butts piled in the ashtray in front of me. Orphaned playing cards, aces and threes and jacks, hearts and clubs and diamonds, dropped and discarded after a long week, littered the carpet at my feet, taunting me. It was our last day in Las Vegas, and my big reveal was crumbling. I needed to improvise, to do something, anything, to pull off my scheme. I had been setting it up for weeks. I couldn't let myself fail. I was surrounded by magicians. They stood all around me, some of whom over the past year had become my best friends. There was Jeremy Griffith, the card junkie from Los Angeles, Xavier Spade, the no-bullshit sleight-of-hand master from New York City, and Chris Ramsey, the bearded and tatted-up YouTube pioneer, the guy who had got me into this mess in the first place. It had been a year since I first fell into the underground world of magic and became friends with its key players. Everything had been building up to this point. I couldn't let it all come tumbling down. It was now or never. We were in Las Vegas for Magic Live, the largest magic convention in the United States. Each August, thousands of professional and amateur magicians flock to the Orleans, a depressing casino a mile south of the main strip and a few years past its prime. Bits and pieces of the theme du jour, or at least the lifestyle associated with the slouchy wetness of New Orleans and the Gulf States, peppered its game room floor, and all the magicians invariably gathered at the Mardi Gras bar for drinks and chatter. This little Bourbon Street-themed lounge had more or less been our home since we showed up a few days earlier. I figured that I had plenty of time to pull off my plan. I thought I was all set. I'd been keeping my secret for months, and it was nearly killing me. But I had devised a scheme, and I was determined to stick with it. "Ramsey," I called out. He was chatting with Xavier. "Come over here. I want to show you something I've been working on." He walked over, and I pulled a new deck of cards from my backpack. My heart raced, and my hand shook as I fumbled with the box's cellophane wrapper, my fingers effectively turning to useless nubs. Ramsey chuckled sarcastically. "Let me know when you get that figured out, bud," he said, turning to walk away. "You open it then," I said. He took the deck from me, tore off the wrapper, and sliced through its adhesive seal with his middle finger, the symbol for the four of spades tattooed on its side near the deepest knuckle. He handed the deck back to me, and I took the cards out of the box. Ramsey hiked up the sagging waist of his jeans, swiveled his baseball cap backwards, stroked his beard, and waited for me to begin. My heart lodged itself in my throat. I wasn't sure words could get past the dense pulse. "Just point to a card," I said, stretching the cards out like a ribbon as I drew my hands apart. Ramsey pointed to one near the middle. "That one?" I asked. He nodded. "Let's have a look." I squared it up and turned it over, revealing Ramsey's selection. "The Two of Clubs," I said. "Good choice. Now let's take your card." I pulled it from the deck, held it in my right hand, and placed the rest of the deck on the table next to us. "And just..." I ripped the card's top right corner, a foot away from Ramsey's face. "Watch," I said, slowly opening my right hand, which held the torn piece. I went from pinky to index, slowly lifting each finger one by one. But when my hand was completely open, there was nothing there. The piece had disappeared. "Check your back pocket," I said after a pause. "No," Ramsey shouted. He smiled, reached into his pocket, and pulled out the ripped corner. "Ah, man," he said, laughing. "Check it," I told him. "Make sure it fits, that it's from the same card." He brought the two pieces together. The torn edges lined up perfectly. "That was really good, man," he said. "You got me. I'm impressed." "But here's the thing," I said, holding out my hand. "Let me see the piece." He placed it into my hand, face up, the two and the club symbol, the card's index, visible to us. "This is a special card." I paused and looked up to him. His brow crinkled, unsure of what I was getting at. "Because this is me now," I said. "I'm the Two of Clubs. I'm in."
Great, thank you. So I noticed you're holding the book, and you've got a tattoo of the Two of Clubs on the inside.
I do.
Of your finger. So tell us how, maybe take us on a little tour of how that came to be.
So, you know, we can get into how this whole thing started, but basically the premise of that prologue is to prime you for what is kind of the, what I would call the top level narrative of the book is about, you know, these magicians and what they're doing now and how I kind of became a part of their world. And, you know, the main hook is that Chris Ramsey and a few other of the main characters in the book are part of a secret society of magicians called the 52. And the 52 is made up of all young magicians who are doing their own thing to help magic progress in the digital age in the 21st century. And when I had first stumbled upon the group and all these people in 2015, there was, I think, 46 members. And the reason why there's a count is because only 52 members are allowed in, hence the 52. But the caveat being that each member of the 52, when they are asked to be in, is given a playing card as their identity in the group. So in the prologue, I mentioned the tattoo on Chris's hand, the four of spades, that's his card. And that is the even deeper thing is that for your induction into this secret society to be official, you have to get the card tattooed on the inside of your middle finger. Yeah. So as you can see from my finger, I obviously became the Two of Clubs. Right. And, you know, that prologue is just a small snip of that weekend in Vegas, which ends the first part of the book. But, you know, after that, we had gotten my tattoo, and, you know, I had been asked into the club by Daniel Madison, who founded the 52 alongside Laura London, who is a female magician from England. So it's, you know, I like the prologue, and we had chosen this specifically because of the tension it creates, mm-hmm. And also the fact you get to meet some of the main characters immediately, mm-hmm. but also it kind of leaves you wondering what the hell you're kind of right. getting at here. Right. So that was definitely a conscious decision where we wanted to introduce the kind of top level hook with it being a secret society, with it being the 52, with it being kind of this thing without really spelling it out. So I enjoy reading the prologue, and I enjoy having that little scene at the very front of the book, because it gets you asking questions, which I think is what a really great prologue does.
Yeah, definitely. So can you then start, tell us how you came to meet Chris at first, and walk us through how this story went from something that you intended to be in a magazine, and how it became your first book.
Right. So, and you know this because I've been coming up and speaking to Champlain students since I graduated from Champlain 10 years ago. So everyone at the college has kind of gotten the yearly update on my life in regards to my career, you know, and, you know, each year is a new set of adventures. So I graduated in 2009 and I moved to New York City, and I had an internship at Rolling Stone for a single semester after that. So the fall of 2009. But if everyone remembers, you know, that was like a pretty hard time economically for the country in general, especially yeah. media. No one knew yet how to make money on the internet.
Yeah.
Obviously podcasting and these sorts of things was not really going on. So it was just kind of weird transition period. So I really had no career opportunities.
Yeah.
And you know, coming from Champlain, you know, and being taught under people like Warren Baker, you know, it was always kind of like, well, you're gonna have to be scrappy to get things done. So I had founded a magazine after I left my internship at Rolling Stone because I really couldn't get a job, and there was really no clear career path for people of my age. And a lot of people who, you know, we kind of reflect on this now, writers in New York, about how weird and frustrating that time was. So that's kind of what started it. And I ran the magazine for a little while, but I really wanted to start freelancing for magazines. You know, bigger publications, like some of the ones that were listed off at the beginning of the interview, like the New Yorker, New York Times, you know, these bigger publications where I could kind of become a better writer. So in 2015, I kind of made that jump to start freelancing as a reporter, but it was really difficult. Mm. And, you know, I depleted my savings and I was just like struggling because I didn't really figure it out in a business sense. I had good ideas. I was getting some assignments, but they weren't really well paid. And I was trying to break into like the kind of upper echelon, and it took a while. Mm-hmm. So by the time summer 2015 came around, I was like dead broke. And I was like, I'm not gonna be able to pay my rent in my apartment in Brooklyn. You know, living in New York is quite expensive, obviously. Yeah. So I called my buddy Nick, and this is all in chapter one. This is how chapter one opens, basically. Yeah. Is I called my buddy Nick, and I'm like, he lives in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I said, dude, like, what do I do? Like, this is crazy. Like, I'm dying over here. And Nick had owns a video production company, and he's like, well, there's an office in my office building that's like vacant next to mine. You know, and there was a little shower in the bathroom and like a kitchenette. And he was like, I mean, you know, if we keep it low profile, you could probably just crash here for free for the summer. And I was like, I'm there. So I found a subletter, took a bus up. I bought like an air mattress to sleep on, and there was a desk in there. And, you know, I basically squatted illegally in this office building for 2.5 months. And it was during that time that I was like really dedicated to trying to finding bigger and better ideas I could I could pitch and hopefully get commissioned by large magazines. And it was during that summer up there that I had first found out about this underground world of young magicians. I had watched a documentary on Netflix called Deceptive Practice, which is a biographical documentary about Ricky Jay, who was an older magician but a very influential one. And he was, you know, this documentary was really great. And because it wasn't just about tricks, it was about his life and the way he lived his life as a magician, you know, and kind of how he saw the world. And I was like, that's so interesting. I never really saw that side of a magician before, but I was like, well, this guy obviously is quite old. He's from the older generation. I thought, well, what's going on with magic nowadays? That could be an interesting story. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of like tooling around on social media and I find Chris. And, you know, I know I described him in the prologue a little bit, but this dude didn't look like any magician I've ever seen before. You know, he was like, you know, well-dressed in that kind of like cool new age streetwear vibe. And he had a beard and tattoos and like a backwards hat. Kind of like a little bit of a hip hop thing going on, but he was really good at magic. And the way he presented himself on social media was quite modern as well, with kind of like the, this influencer model of, you know, self-marketing. So I reached out to him and I was like, hey, you know, I'm just like a curious journalist, like what's going on with magic nowadays? And that kind of started our friendship and correspondence in the very early part of this journey. Mm-hmm. And him and I were in touch on the phone and over email and by text for about 5 or 6 months before we first met in person. Where I went to a magic convention with him in February 2016. And that opens chapter 2 of the book, but that's when things really started getting serious.
So you had originally conceptualized this story idea as something for Wired,
yeah,
right?
As a magazine piece. They had commissioned a draft of the story, but after that trip and I wrote the draft, like I realized... like the story was good, but it wasn't exactly what I think a magazine wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, a magazine like Wired wanted. Like they want everything, you know, and a lot of magazines, they like their stories to feel a certain way or be structured a certain way to fit in the box that, you know, needs to be checked for
sure.
A publication.
Yeah.
And I've done tons of stories that fit this, but I was trying too hard to put everything into this story and it just really wasn't working. So they ended up killing the story. And I was pretty devastated at that. But then I kind of realized that it's just bigger than a magazine article could carry. It's like a whole world. It wasn't just one thing. It was a whole world that I had discovered.
Yeah.
And obviously, too, after I got back from that convention, I was like completely obsessed with magic. And I was just like continuing to kind of – I was trying to learn magic and I was still hanging out with these guys and meeting up with new people. And, you know, and it just kept snowballing.
Yeah.
And I think that – come about spring, probably about summer, early summer 2016, I really was like, I think I have a book on my hands, just because of how this was going. Like it was becoming my life quite quickly. So that's when the gears started turning in terms of putting this into book form.
Right. So at what point in the writing of the book are you starting to be seen by the 52 as one of them?
Well, I think that what happened was I was asked to be in the 52 in, I want to say, July 2016. So I'd gone to the Magic Convention in February 2016. And then between February and July, I was, you know, still talking with these people as friends and learning magic. And I was, you know, hanging out with, you know, a couple of people who lived in New York. And just like becoming part of the community in like a pretty organic way, because I was just kind of becoming obsessed with it on a personal level. I found it so fascinating, so, so fascinating. And, you know, I get a phone call from Daniel Madison in July, and he was like, you know, because I told him, I said, well, maybe this could be a book, I don't really know, but it's like, this is something big, you know, and I feel like it's just something really great. And he said to me, he's like, well, you know, if you're going to do a book on the 52, you have to be a member of the 52. And that's when he invited me in.
Yeah.
And I kept it a secret from Chris Ramsey. And that's what the prologue really is about, is I'm revealing to him that I'm a member of the 52 and I've become the two of clubs.
Yeah.
So in terms of, from the perspective of me writing it or understanding how to make this into a book, by that time, by the time I was in the 52 and I revealed it to Chris, you know, I didn't have an agent, you know, I didn't have any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I had no idea really what I was doing in that regard, but I knew that I had a really amazing idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what kind of started the, okay, this is definitely strong enough for a book now that I'm in this club and I got the tattoo and it's like, I'm here and like, this isn't going away and this is my life now.
Right.
And I could translate this into a participatory journalism book.
Right.
And I think I'm ready now. I have a strong enough foundation to start looking for representation, to start putting together a book proposal, to try to figure out how to do this, because obviously my first book wasn't represented by anyone. I really had no idea what I was doing, but that that's really solidified the confidence in me to say I can move forward with this.
Yeah. What I love most about this book, and I love a lot of things about it, my favorite thing is how you treat the characters. Daniel Madison, Laura London, Chris Ramsey, and you know, about a dozen other people, you introduce us to them as individuals, spend a lot of time really watching you get to know them, and then the reader gets to know them as people throughout the book. It's so it doesn't feel, it feels more like memoir than journalism. And part of the reason it feels like memoir, well, it is memoir, but it's because you are also, as the central character, are also a really well-crafted, built-out character. So you can tell from reading Magic is Dead that you did a whole lot of personal work and growth and development. And I want to talk to you for a minute about whether you felt ready for that, and because you really captured it beautifully. You had to really become, I imagine you started out by thinking you were writing about other people and ended up writing about yourself along with them.
Right. And that sort of process took a long time to develop because I'm not an essayist. I'm not a memoir writer. I've never written personal essays about myself. And I think a lot of that stems from me perhaps not wanting to publicize or come to terms with the things I've experienced, you know. And one of the main emotional threads of this story, you know, I've been categorizing these, like, top level is like just the raw narrative of what happened to me, but then the emotional layer underneath it is what carries the story and makes it really rich, is that my father passed away when I was 13. And an interesting factoid that kind of ties into Magic is my mother is a poker player, and she started using poker. She played when she was younger, but started using poker again after he passed away to kind of reestablish her identity in a way, and to kind of escape and using deception in that way. And in a way, you know, I've been kind of on a similar journey, you know, after something like that. You know, a father's supposed to usher you into adulthood and kind of help cement who you are in the world. And I really didn't have that sort of system as I became a teenager and a young adult. So I've too have been trying to search for the truest version of myself just in my own personal life, right? And my mother has been a huge part of that. And she's a huge part of the book because that's true. But as I'm with these people and hearing their backstories and understanding them more deeply as characters and as friends of mine, and understanding I'm going to have to translate their experiences into this book, I kind of had an epiphany, like, oh my God, like, we're all on the same journey here.
Yeah.
We're trying to find the truest version of ourselves, and these people, and I invariably do the same thing, are using magic as a way, as a tool and a vessel for that exploration and that self-discovery. And that's kind of what the book is really about. It's not really this, like, kind of adventurous jaunt through the world of magic. It's at its core of coming-of-age story.
Yeah.
And I know we were talking about this in the car on the way here, but I was very much in denial about that until, you know, very late in the editing process with my editor, Carrie Thornton at Day Street Books, who has a really dense history in editing celebrity memoir and these more deep emotional stories.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I sold the book on and what I pitched it as, I think Carrie could see the threads that she could pull out of me once we were further along. And, you know, the book changed very much as the adventure continued and as things happened and much more color was put in. And then, you know, when we got down to editing the book, you know, she had really drawn out that hyper-personal stuff that made it all come together. Because as you read the book, you get to chapters about my dad and my mom and you're like, well, what does it have to do with magic? And then by the end, it's just like all the threads tie in very neatly and you really understand what the book's about.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really, I appreciate that when we were talking before we were on the air, you were sort of really honest about like what that felt like to think you were done and turn in a draft to your editor and then maybe get, I don't know, maybe a call, an email that said, I think you want to throw out 20,000 words and, and write three more chapters.
Well, the funny thing is about that is that, you know, Carrie is very astute at understanding what you're trying to do without you yet doing it, you know?
Yeah.
And she's very good at pulling out things from writers who are writing in the first person that they perhaps know subconsciously they should, but they're not ready to do yet.
Yeah.
And that's basically what she did with me, you know? I submitted the book like a month ahead of schedule, and it was like 90,000 words. I hadn't yet gotten the endings. I had a planned trip to England to see Daniel for the last time, Daniel Madison, you know, and the last chapters with him.
Yeah.
So I still was like, I was like, you know, 90% complete, read it. And I kind of knew deep down that it was going to come, but she called me a month later and was like, hey, come by the office. I want to talk to you. And I'm in my head, I'm like, oh, God, here we go.
So you're in person.
Yeah.
So you can't hide.
Yeah. So I go into the HarperCollins office, you know, which is this like monolithic type of, you know, this just this kind of institutional, super kind of imposing, you know, feeling to walk into that. I remember walking in there trying to sell the book to them. And, you know, every time I walk in there, it's still a little bit intimidating. They have, just a side note, they have like the original To Kill a Mockingbird, like in like a glass case,
wow.
like with like a letter from Harper Lee in there. Anyways,
that's not intimidating at all.
You walk by all this stuff and then it's like, oh, you know, here's little Ian coming in. So anyways, Carrie had me in the office and she sits me down and she has like a very kind of like therapist sort of look on her face, you know. She's like, Ian. I'm like, just say it. She's like, there's not enough of you in the book. And I go, oh, I know.
But you knew. You knew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew. And I knew. But I was in denial about what the book was really about, you know. I didn't want to do that because I was scared, you know.
So let me just stop you. You didn't want to do what? Let's kind of spell it out for our readers.
I didn't want to reveal so much about myself in that way.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be vulnerable publicly.
Right.
Because although that makes the best writing, it's the hardest for a writer to do.
Absolutely.
But the thing was is that I had about 20,000 words of stuff about my dad and my mom in a vault in my Google Drive that I had written. And I was working on it actually pretty rigorously with Adam Ross, who is the editor of the Swanee Review, which is like a really prominent literary publication from Tennessee. And, you know, him and I have been slowly working on it because I kind of wanted to write a personal essay about that from like for a very prominent outlet because I didn't really want to cheapen it by having it just go online or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, all right, Carrie, you know, I have this document. I'm going to send it to you. And I told Adam that I think I'm going to have to use it for the book, which he was completely cool with. So I sent it to her. And then the next day she called me and she was like, okay, we got the goods.
This is what we need. Yeah.
She's like, give me a little while. So I waited, and the document I had was very strong in terms of how I viewed my own writing. It was very, very strong.
Okay.
And it was pretty well structured too. So what she did was she just took chunks of this document and made chapters out of them.
How about that?
So she would just take chunks of this document and she basically sent me the book back and just pasted chunks of this document within the book I had already written. And also, like you said, like cut out a bunch of stuff that just didn't seem either compelling or relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always Carrie's thing, is like, is it compelling or is it relevant to what we're really doing here? And a lot of this stuff was just kind of like a travelogue where I'm kind of like, now we're here, we're doing this, and now we're here, and we're doing that. And Carrie's like, I don't really care about this stuff because it's just you on this adventure, but these scenes you're writing in these chapters don't tie into us feeding towards a logistical climax or us feeding towards an emotional climax.
Right. I do want to jump in here and say, though, that there are touches of that. There's a history of magic as it's performed, mm-hmm. as it's written about. Mm-hmm. You talk about several different books that magicians today use to train themselves.
Right.
And you talk about their conversations. And you have, I hope I don't butcher this guy's name, but Grant Ashatz, I've never said it out loud, who has a Linea restaurant in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the idea of magic that he brings to his restaurant. I mean, it's really far reaching in terms of, it really embraces the history of magic and the industry as it's practiced today. So you also accomplish that in this book, same book.
I definitely wanted to bring in history of magic for the sole purpose of, well, for two purposes. One, a lot of the tidbits about magic's history is quite interesting and not really well known, but it gives you a great primer as to how magic has evolved and how the concept of magic or illusion or deception can be seen in other facets of modern culture, like Grant's restaurant. You know, he's on this Netflix documentary series where he talks about his restaurant, and he says on the show, it's like a magic show.
Right.
He says that, you know, it's that quote in the book. So that's kind of like, I wanted to kind of build that context.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like you're kind of missing something and it's just a story, but you really wanted to have a little bit of background. But there were obviously just some parts of the book that I had written for the first draft that just felt a little dead. Like, okay, we're a little bored. Like, you know, why? Like, this, there's not enough at stake with this scene or this part of the book. So Carrie was really good at streamlining. And we cut a lot of history out too. Mm-hmm. Or we just, you know, condensed it. Where she was like, we want to feel sated as we go, but we're ready for the next thing, and we want to make sure we hit all the beats where it's like, you know, introduce character, develop character one, develop character two, develop self, you know, hit beat two when you go into my personal history, and then you continue, and then we're in this place, we're in that place, a little history, and like, it's kind of just this kind of revolving door of all the little touches you need to grab onto as the book progresses, so the reader doesn't get bored or distracted. So she was really good at refining the text I had on a structural level and then obviously injecting all the personal stuff to make it feel more emotionally sound and more emotionally resonant and relevant to what the journey really did for me on a personal level, but also how you start to realize that everyone in this book, including me, is on a similar journey.
Yeah.
And you understand as the book goes on what we're really getting at here.
Yeah.
It's not really about me learning magic tricks, is it? You know? And it comes slowly, but once you get towards the end, you have the logistical climax, which I come to invent my own magic trick and I put it on, I get it featured on this website where you can purchase to see how it's done, but the emotional tie-in too, where there's a climax for all of it together at the end. And that was very much Carrie's expertise in making sure that as the book was edited and we were rewriting some stuff and cutting things, that those core elements were the things we focused on the most.
Yeah. It's occurring to me right now as you're speaking what a much different book this would have been if it was published by anybody else in the world.
Yeah. And that's a really strange thing about this whole journey, and I have to kind of remind myself about what I actually got myself into, because it was completely spontaneous, you know. And
you mean how do you came to work with Day Street Books? Maybe we talk a little bit about that happened.
The whole thing is spontaneous. The story, the book publisher, working with Carrie, you know, it's like, that's what makes the book good, I think, is that I didn't plan it. It wasn't like, you know, this is relevant now, so I'm going to go out and do this, you know. It came very organically, and I think that, kind of like you said, like, how would it have been different if someone else had wrote it? And I think it would have been very different, because what I brought to the table was wholly mine and exclusively mine. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what really made the book really good. And, you know, all the different parts, the agent I secured, you know, which I basically cold pitched agents. I mean, I can take you through that, like that whole process.
Well, then, I mean, I remember from a talk you gave maybe last year that in itself was kind of an involved process that involved you writing a book proposal a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
And I think you came out with a book proposal that you could not have foreseen what that would look like.
Yeah. Well, the book proposal process was quite frustrating because I'm obviously living the narrative of this book every day, so it was changing in real time.
Yeah.
I'd call up my agent Larry and Sasha, their husband and wife duo from Brooklyn, and I'm like, guys, we got to change this. Like, something new happens, and, you know, some crazy stuff just went down when I added in, you know. But that whole process was interesting, you know, because I'm quite, you know, I'm quite entrepreneurial. So I like to kind of go out there and like learn from experience and kind of like dive in and see what happens. So at the time when I was writing the book proposal, I didn't know what the book proposal really was. So I just kind of got a sample and I just kind of copied what I had found online. And then I joined Publishers Marketplace, which is a kind of a database website for agents, publishers, and writers where you can kind of look up agents, what type of deals they make, what type of stuff that they represent, who they work with, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of a great research tool. So I got on there and I searched the best agents for narrative nonfiction, mainly by reporters, books by journalists, and I cold pitched the top 25. And I sent them all this kind of short cryptic message and, you know, because, you know, I want to kind of be on brand with the whole magic thing. And I said, I can send you what I've, you know, I can send you my book proposal if you'd like. And I took about six offers, but I got a lot of rejections after they read the proposal because they were like, I can't sell a book without an ending yet. So that's a very weird thing to deal with where you're like, I'm living the story now, you know, but how do you guarantee an ending that's going to be satisfying for the reader?
Right.
But Larry Weissman and his wife, Sasha Alper, they are like a power duo in the nonfiction space because they only represent journalists. They only do narrative nonfiction. They specialize in this one type of book. Wow. And, you know, they've done amazing books, number one bestsellers that have been made into movies, Pulitzer Prize winners. And they saw the relevancy of this as a marketable piece of writing. Like magic's coming back into vogue. It's going to be even hotter in a couple of years when this book comes out. It's a great story. The structure's good. So they signed me on, and we worked on the book proposal for about 9 months before we took it to market because things were changing, because we were refining it, because you only have one shot to sell a book, really. Mm-hmm. But during that time, Larry was doing his own kind of groundwork, and he was teasing some editors about it. And one of the editors he was really teasing was Carrie Thornton at Day Street. Because Carrie does predominantly celebrity memoir. She only really does memoir and pop culture books, music stuff. She edits Rob Sheffield, who's a writer at Rolling Stone. You know, he did this Beatles book recently, which was really well received.
Yeah.
So she does a lot of this kind of like edgier pop culture / celebrity memoir stuff. And she read the proposal and loved it. I think she saw the potential in it. I mean, I look back on the proposal now and it's good, but I think that a lot of the really great stuff that ended up in the final copy of the book was perhaps missing, but she saw the potential in it. We took a meeting, they made a preempt offer 2 days later, signed the deal, and it was done.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah. I think that's quite atypical, but I think that you know, it gets back to a point that I try to make when I speak to other writers, especially younger writers, is that nothing else matters except for your idea. You're pitching a magazine, you're pitching a book, you're pitching an agent. If the idea is larger than life, if the idea is fleshed out, if the idea makes sense, if you can execute it, the idea will carry you towards opportunity.
Yeah.
So that's basically like why I think this book happened, was because the idea was so incredibly strong and unique.
Right. Yeah, that leads us right into what we like to do on Write the Book is ask our authors to give a prompt to listeners around any project they might be working on or wanting to start. And I think we're about halfway there with this idea about the idea.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I like to speak from the perspective of a journalist, right? Someone whose job it is to go out there and translate experience to a reader. And as you had said first off when we sat down, was that this book is great because the characters are so strong.
Yeah.
So I think a really great prompt is to kind of get out of your own head and out of yourself a little bit. And what I really love to do is to, especially I'm looking for pieces of journalism to sell as magazine articles, as I say, show me a compelling person. Let's find a compelling person. And this is, you know, you have levels of this. Everyone knows that person in their town, right? That's just a well-known character. That it's just, you know, the guy hanging down, you know, at the gas station, you know? Like, you know, everyone's got a story, you know? Or maybe it's like the local mayor or, you know, the owner of a store or your neighbor that's lived there for 60 years, you know? Everyone has a story. And early on in my career, I would just look for these characters who could carry a narrative, you know? Nothing else carries a narrative more than character, right? Because they make the plot move. I think a really great prompt for writers, especially people who are trying to get better at translating character onto the page, is to go out there and listen to people's stories. And this can be a personal writing prompt, but this is really the foundation of really great journalism, is finding characters who embody a greater sense of purpose outside of themselves. They are reflections of things that are going on in the world. And most everyone that's lived their life is a reflection of that.
Yeah.
You know? And most people kind of live under the radar. But as you hear their stories, you understand their relevance.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if anyone's listening, I would just have you literally go out, talk to people, hear their stories, have them tell you stories about their life, and maybe try to start to translate that onto the page, because that stuff is what's going to make other people interested in your work, because you understand character, because that's what readers really want. They want character. So maybe get out there and meet some people. Write some stuff related to them, even if it's just for fun.
Yeah.
And that can help you and prime you for future writing projects that may get read by a wide audience.
That is a fantastic prompt. Ian, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been really fun.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
That once more was a conversation with Ian Frisch about his new book, Magic is Dead. Ian is a graduate of our own Champlain College Professional Writing Program, and he will be reading at Champlain tomorrow night at 6:30 in the Perry Hall. Perry 240 Presentation Room. And you can learn more about Ian's work at ianfrisch.com. His last name is F-R-I-S-C-H. Okay, I have an announcement to make about this show. I'm going to announce this each week from now until it happens. Please help me spread the word. Write the Book begins airing for just a single hour from 4 to 5 p.m. beginning on April 1st. This is not a joke or an April Fool's prank. We'll still be on Monday afternoons, but we will go to a single hour each week from 4 to 5 p.m. As a result, the show will air fewer reruns. If you're a regular listener, you probably realize that a lot of times in the second hour of the show, I'm running reruns. The content of WBTV LP is filling. It's wonderful. There's all kinds of new shows coming in, all kinds of new DJs with ideas. There are also some syndicated shows that we're running, such as Democracy Now! And lots of other shows. And so this show is going to go to 1 hour, and it'll be mostly new interviews. So thank you for tuning in on Mondays from 4 to 5 starting April 1st. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website as well. My website is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show, or if you have any news about book-related events that you'd like announced during the Bookworm's calendar some week, I do that every week that I have time at the end of the show. Please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.